News Radio KMAN in focus. We are in segment number two. And we have another segment coming up later in the hour here. General retired Perry Wiggins will be joining us as we'll get an update from the General's Military Council or the Governor's Military Council. But today we are having our regular visit with Marty Vanier from NBAF, Development Director. Marty, welcome.
Thank you. I'm feeling very safe today. I'm sort of bookended by the fort, so I'm feeling really safe today.
That would be a good way to put that. Is this the first time that I've interviewed you?
Yeah, second or third, maybe. Second,
maybe? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes I lose track of things. But it's a delight to have you here. There's all kinds of things going on. I drive by, you know, pretty frequently, and, you know, a lot of the outer work is already done. I know there's a lot of enclosing of things, but, boy, that thing just is massive.
Yes, it is. And I was able to do a walkthrough on Tuesday morning, and it's incredible. Wall studs are going up. Glass is going up. It's going to be fully enclosed here in, I don't know, a couple, 3 months. We'll have to start the utility plant up again so that we have heating and cooling for all of the inside work. Coatings are going on walls and floors. HEPA filters are going in. And even though, particularly the HEPA filter space, even though in the early days it was just this gigantic open space, it's now being filled with metal boxes and ductwork and this, that, and the other, and you're not going to be able to just run wildly through the space. You know, it's going to be a huge obstacle course when all of that equipment gets in there.
Does it seem like it gets more exciting every time you go out there?
It does. And, you know, and I'm the newbie. I mean, I'm not the one that was there when they were designing it and starting on construction and whatnot, but yes, it's just really fun to see everything that's going in there and hear the stories and hear about the complexities of the building and what's going in and all of the engineering and how much attention is being paid to every little detail. I have fun facts like when we walked through and I'm looking at some of the wall studs and there are like dabs of colors of paint on the wall studs. And so I was asking what that was all about. I mean, was somebody just being cute or what's the deal? Apparently, each color is assigned to a particular contractor or subcontractor, and so they dab the stud when they're finished working in on that space. So if you, so for instance, this room we're in right now, imagine this is a laboratory, and so these, and they're metal studs, and so here are all these metal studs, and they all have all these dabs of colors, and it means that the contractors have been in, they've worked that space, and they're finished with it. It's been inspected, and they're finished, and they've moved on. So that way, the construction guys can walk through and can know, yeah, this space has been cleared. This space has not been cleared. So it was just one of those fun little things.
I can see that would be one of the greatest challenges, is the coordination of all the subcontractors that are involved. And how many are there? Do you have any idea how many subcontractors?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Bunches. I have no idea. I can tell you there are 700 people on site.
Uh-huh.
But how that's divided up, that detail I don't have.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And the trucks in the parking lot are from everywhere. I mean, there are trucks, yes, trucks from Kansas. There are trucks from Oklahoma and Texas and Illinois and Colorado and everywhere. California. I mean, there are trucks with license plates from everywhere.
Fascinating project. I'm anxious to see what it looks like once the glass is fully up. And I think that's going to be probably one of the first times people are really going to get an idea of what this thing's going to look like when it's all said and done.
Yeah. Yeah, it's coming pretty close. It's coming pretty close, but it won't be long. It'll be just a couple months.
Wow. Okay. Exciting moments there.
Yep.
You got so many things that are going on. I know there was the whole transition possibly with the, you know, the project going over to the USDA. Anything new on that?
Well, yes, we're in the midst of planning the transition with our partners at USDA. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about today, because it is really important and a lot of people have asked about it, is some of the literally physical transfers that are going to take place. A really important one is the transfer of what's called the biorepository, which are all the samples of viruses that USDA keeps on hand to either use for research, or a lot of times those samples are used as a comparison if we've got, if they have an unknown virus and they need to try to figure out what it is, then you can match it to some of the items that they have in the repository. So a big part of the planning right now is planning that biorepository transfer. It was a topic of the CLG meeting, which we had a couple of weeks ago, in which I had a couple of folks from USDA down to talk with the CLG, and that was one of the items in talking about the CLG is how are you going to move this stuff from Plum Island to NBAF? And one of the first things that USDA has to do is go through their essentially archive that they have on Plum Island, all these thousands of samples, and figure out what do they want to keep, what do they not want to keep, and so those are items that will be destroyed and not moved, but what do they want to keep, and catalog all of those.
You got that, Nick?
ESB Financial, member FDIC.
Okay, turn that. Just pull that pot down. Pull that down. There we go. Okay. Now you can push some buttons and get it back on track. That's all right. That's all right.
That's okay.
Sometimes these things happen.
Happened
to me this morning, too.
It's okay. Mm-hmm. It's all right. We all have to be flexible and ready to adjust.
That's why we smile all the way through it.
That's why we
flexible
do.
And ready to adjust, and that's like right. Nothing that happens in your world.
Oh, No, never. So we're doing a lot of planning, and it was a really interesting conversation. And one of the things that I wanted to do, so this is the curveball that I'm throwing to you.
Okay.
So people a lot of times want to understand how these viruses are stored and why we're worried and planning so hard for transferring the biorepository. And one of the things that I've tried to explain to people is that the samples are really small and the viruses are frozen. And so that's in frozen at incredibly low temperature. I mean, this is way beyond your home freezer. So that is one of the issues that we have to talk about in transferring the biorepository is what samples move, so we know the volume, but then the other part of it is they have to remain frozen during the transfer. So here's my test for you, Dave.
Oh my.
Here's my test for you.
Great.
I have...
You're going to learn a lot about what Dave doesn't know today, folks.
Okay, so thanks to my friend Steve, who's out there listening, I've brought you it's empty and never been used, but a vial that's used to store virus in.
Oh, really?
Yes, so it's a visual aid.
Okay.
So I'm going to let you describe it to the audience, because here we are doing visual aids on a radio show.
It looks like a capsule with little fins on it that almost look like a rocket ship without a nose on the top. And it's about, what, an inch and 3/8 tall and about 3/8 inch round, and it looks like you could put like one big horse pill in it.
Very good.
Is that close?
That's very close.
This is,
yeah, I mean, sounds good to me.
This is plastic, and I bet it's probably recyclable. Not that you'll recycle these.
No, I don't think we'll recycle them. No, I don't think so.
So what's these little fins on the end of it? There are six of them.
I suspect that's meant to secure them. In
oh,
the
so
little,
when you put them in, they have
when
a
you put
bit
them in a little rack,
ice or
yeah.
Something. Okay,
you put them in a little rack. Yeah.
Okay.
So
I unscrewed it, and that was easy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the interior, just like I said, you could put a vitamin pill.
Yeah.
Inside that, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And you freeze these at a whole bunch below Celsius.
Yeah, they're I'm not sure what the Celsius conversion is, but a lot of these are frozen at minus 80 degrees.
Okay.
And some of them even more frozen than that. I don't know how you get more frozen, but some of them are more frozen than that. One of the debates that actually we're going through right now with respect to NBAF is that you have two different systems you can use. You can either use a mechanical freezer, which would be like your home freezer, or you can use liquid nitrogen.
I was wondering if the liquid nitrogen might be a factor in that.
Yeah. And so one of the there are pros and cons to each of those systems, and so we're kind of going through that right now with respect to, what are the pros and cons of mechanical versus liquid nitrogen, and so which one is better. So it's details like that we go through. And
you're not keeping that from my fingerprints, are you?
No.
All right.
No, because mine are all over it, so
okay,
that's
good.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. But I just had this little thing as a demonstration because most people can't visualize how the viruses are stored.
And that probably would contain, what, one centimeter? Is that how that would probably be?
It would be, well, yeah, a cc or a milliliter, which are essentially the same. I'm not sure that it even would hold that much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's for sure not much.
Yeah.
Like it would be, four or five drops out of an eyedropper.
Maybe so, yeah.
Would be about the volume. So it's just an itty-bitty little thing. But there are, thousands of these that are kept in the archives for research purposes, for identifying unknown strains, that sort of thing. Because as we've talked before, viruses tend to mutate over time. So if you want to understand the difference between a disease happening right now and compare it to something that happened 20 years ago, the only way you can do that is if you have the samples and then you can compare them, whether it's doing it by genomics or doing it by putting them in a cell culture and seeing what it does to the cells, whatever. But you have to have a lot of these samples and a lot of these archives. It's like, like people collecting coins or collecting stamps in the sense that you can sort of see what happens in the progression over time.
Wow.
So anyway.
That's fascinating.
So there you go.
And yet it's very simple.
Mm-hmm. It's very simple.
Very simple.
It's very simple.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have a lot of time. Thank you for your patience in getting allowing Colonel Schrader in here. Some other quick updates here that you have on the MBAF facility and some other operational aspects maybe?
Well, operations planning is huge, and we're going into that full steam right now. Construction is still, thank goodness for the team over there in the trailers, construction is still on time, on budget. Things are looking good. We're going to get to what they call initial operating capability, IOC. We'll get to IOC on time in 2020. And it's just, everyone's just very, very excited about where we are right now because it is very, very real. The USDA folks are here quite often as we talk through a lot of transition activities. I will be with several of them over in Kansas City the end of August, actually just right before the next show, for the Animal Health Corridor events. It's about 3 days worth of events in Kansas City. And one of them that I'm really excited for the USDA people to get to see is the investment forum. So if you think about Shark Tank for the animal health world, that's what this is like. Mm-hmm. These are small and mid-sized companies that have a great idea or have some preliminary research and need funding to move on or whatever. And they make presentations to a panel. There's a winner at the end. The real action is out in the hallway where people are having meetings with a lot of these companies and talking about research and talking about investment and whatnot. But it's a really, really fun activity, and I think the folks from USDA will really appreciate that because it gets them connected with a lot of these small and mid-sized research firms that have great ideas that could potentially assist or inform some of the NBAF research.
It's an exciting time and getting more and more lively.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And as if the construction wasn't lively enough.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Dr. Marty Vanier, a development director with NBAF here, joining us for the program. Always a delight to have you here. Thanks for bringing us up to date and for the visual.
Yeah.
Yeah. This doesn't go in my trophy case, does it?
No, sorry.
You got to take it back?
I do.
Okay.
Sorry.
Right. Fine. That's fine. Maybe I should take a picture of it. We'll put it on our Facebook page.
Okay.
So we know what it is. Listeners know what it's like.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
General Perry Wiggins from the Governor's Military Council to join us next on K-Man's In Focus.
Some people are telling you the governor's race is just between two career politicians, two who helped create the mess in Topeka, two peas in a pod. If you like the pea soup of politics as usual, they're your choice. But Ken Selzer, CPA, knows we can do better.
Like you, I've had enough. They're part of the broken system. I'm the candidate for governor and businessman who in just 3 years